Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. This is Dave. For those of you who listened to the recording and weren't able to be here last time, as well as any of you who were here with questions or clarifications, anything that would be helpful from that first seminar for us to talk about after you sort of let it marinate for a while and see if it made sense to you and is applicable, any thoughts or questions about it? Well, anyone want to add anything about what you want to really focus on in this whole topic area, or what you want to walk away with? Any other thoughts about that from any of you on the line now? Or I could just proceed and deal with my loneliness, and we'll move right into the topic. Unless there are questions or things that you'd like to talk about, anything at all that you would feel helpful for us to discuss. Well, I'm going to put us on lecture mode, and we will definitely have some time at the end, so I'll be eager to hear from you if there are things that you'd like to discuss, or ideas that you have, or things you just want to explore. We're going to talk in this seminar about the neuroscience of peak performance. First, I'd like to talk about a confidence blueprint. Olympic gold medalist Nuruddin Marcelli of Algeria said, "When I race, my mind is full of doubts. Who will finish second? Who will finish third?" Dr. Denton Cooley, a medical colleague here in Houston, offered his version. "When you're asked to name the top three surgeons in the world, you should have trouble thinking of the other two." Now that's a little extreme, maybe, but neuroscience does show that the state of mind of confidence is more correlated with success than either competence or expertise. And think about that. Confidence is a state of mind. I have a blog called that, Confidence is a State of Mind. It's in the archives under the blog tab on my website, MentorPath, that will elaborate a bit more if you have time and interest to do that. Confidence is both art and neuroscience and initiates access to the mindset containing the necessary skills established by deliberate practice. Now, that's a summary of what we're going to talk about and look at how to develop. But here's an illustration to begin with. David Scott Yeager assigned 44 seventh grade students to write an essay about a personal hero. The teachers marked the essays and provided written feedback. The researchers divided the essays randomly into two piles. On one, they added a generic note in the teacher's handwriting saying, "I'm giving you these comments so you'll have feedback for your paper." The essays in the second pile received a note saying, "I'm giving you these comments because I have very high expectations and know you can reach them." When the papers were returned, students were offered the option to revise and resubmit their paper for a potentially better grade. For those students who received the generic note, just almost 40% revised their papers. For the students who received the encouraging high expectation notes, 80% revised their papers and made more than twice as many corrections as the first group. Confidence, like any state of mind, is contagious. Beliefs are a feeling of certainty about what something means. When you have a certainty, your brain will find a way. This is now demonstrated in brain studies. Belief in someone transforms a state of mind in the recipient to a more creative, integrative state. Success most often has to do with two things: the state of mind of confidence that we engage in endeavor, and how we manage an optimum performance state to develop those skills and sustain it under pressure-inducing circumstances. Confidence is a belief that you can create a successful outcome through your actions. It's initially subjective, an emotional regard of a promise that you live into then. Confidence is an internal sense that I can make this work. Optimism is the belief everything is going to work out. Confidence projects confidence in a number of studies of practicing experts and their recommendations. Let's apply the neuroconditioning chart to create an optimum state of confidence. And rather than starting with a negative emotional trigger, start with a positive one. Here's an example. My daughter wanted me to join her to run a portion of the Boston Marathon with her from the days that she was in college there. She wanted me to join her at Boston College and for us to run together the last 7 miles to the finish line. Well, she learned how hard it was to qualify for the marathon, both sponsorship and times. After she got her doctorate and moved back to Boston, it became a reality when she qualified and obtained sponsorship. For me, excited and horrified kind of blended together. Now, while I'm an athlete, lifetime distance running is not my thing. Running has always been in relation to some ball. I knew I was going to have to develop some way to sustain focus and tolerate the rigors and the pain of training to cross the finish line together. Now, one of my favorite sayings is, "Fate whispered to the warrior, you cannot withstand the storm." The warrior whispered back, "I am the storm." Every time in my training, when I would otherwise quit earlier, rationalize stopping about because of pain, that mantra, "I am the storm," sustained my effort. It kept me in that performance zone. Many "I am the storms" later, we crossed the finish line shoulder to shoulder. Now, how does this work? The brain chemistry that establishes optimum confidence is led by serotonin, the neurochemical messenger that keeps us and helps us remain calm and make rational decisions. Confidence establishes ample serotonin in the prefrontal cortex, the command center of the brain for rational thought and decision making. In brain chemistry, and this is important, there's an inverse ratio of stress and confidence. With psychological threat or anxiety, stress of some sort, the challenge is to regulate state of mind to maintain serotonin and sustain confidence, to sustain the state of mind of that practice skill, whether it's intellectual, physical, whatever it is. Another transmitter that directly affects confidence is oxytocin. This chemical transmitter, mediating bonding and connection, fosters an internal mindset of confidence. This connection can be to important others or to an internal ideal. So here's a related application, and those of you doing professional coaching will recognize this immediately. Neuroscience research shows that the first words spoken in a conversation trigger a neurochemical reaction in the listener to boot up a specific mindset. That mindset then processes the remainder of the conversation and determines meaning and significance. Now, this is huge for any leader or collaborator, from business to sports to parenting to mentor coaching. For example, a conversation that begins with remarks perceived as authoritative or critical or adversarial in any way, even perceived in that way, activates the brain defensive circuitry of flight, fright, or freeze, mediated by stress chemicals, cortisol, and adrenaline. The listener then experiences some degree of guardedness or anxiety or mistrust, and in some ways closes down for self-protection. The subsequent conversation after those first few words and the mindset booted up determines the remainder of the conversation. Now, consider on the other hand, a conversation that begins in a collaborative mode. An empathic resonance, a collaborative mode, activates oxytocin, the brain's neurochemical system, relating to bonding and connection. This initial perception of a collaborative, trusting discussion induces a desire to listen without judgment, to pay full attention to the speaker, and frames the remainder of the conversation. This is what we do in mentor coaching. It's a collaborative framework. The listener feels safe, heard, understood. Trust develops with openness to further collaboration to optimize performance and results. Same thing with performance coaches, and I've coached a number of them, from sports to intellectual to artistic mentors and coaches. Same principle, which is huge, I think. Building confidence requires, even demands, hard work, risk, persistence, even tolerating failure. Gaining confidence regularly means going outside a comfort zone and tolerating setbacks with determination and resilience. Comfortable and confident are not prerequisites, but the result of effective engagement. In other words, you know, I'll do this when I get more confidence. That won't work. It happens the opposite way. So how can you prime your mind and brain to prepare for an anticipated situation and establish a mindset of confidence? Well, here's one way not to do it. This is from Alexander Wolfe, writing in Sports Illustrated. By yelling at his point guard for missing that wide-open teammate in the corner, the coach has probably ensured that it will happen again. A common perception is that the best way to get employees or players or executives to perform is by pointing out mistakes, threats, or being intense. Now, negative emotion does grab attention, but a positive focus works considerably better to develop confidence as a mindset and the associated aspects of loyalty, bonding, personal development, and even commitment to a group. Priming of mind and brain to prepare for an anticipated situation establishes the foundation of a mindset of confidence. Now, this is in your outline. There are 7 strategies for successfully priming for confidence. I'll just review them here, but I would suggest really look at them and apply them to your situation from the outline. Have a mantra for grounding and centering. And when you do it enough, simply doing the cue, whether it's touching your index finger and thumb together or saying the focus phrase, that alone will instantly boot up an optimum performance mindset that houses the deliberate practice of that skill. We're going to talk about deliberate practice in a bit. Secondly, ask yourself positive, powerful questions to induce serotonin. Our focus follows our questions. So ask good questions, powerful, positive questions. Recall a time of successful accomplishment of a similar challenge. Remember, this is one of the things we may ask a client at times when they have no clue about figuring out a new situation. Was there ever a time in the past analogous to this that you can think of that had a positive outcome? Identify moments of significant confidence. Same principle. A feeling of, I can do it, or whatever it takes. Focus on connections with important others to activate oxytocin response. Have a mental imagery of the successful completion to live into. And cultivate a circle of supportive people and mentors. Now, this is not a sequence. This is not in order. But these are just things to think about to find what works best and when. For those of you who have played the game Taboo, you have a target word on a card that you've drawn that you want your partner who can't see the card to say given your single word clues without gestures. Now, this is almost impossible for me to not use my hands to say only one word. You know, my usual sentence, 372 words. Also on that card, with the target word, are a half dozen words that you cannot use. So, target words at the top, there are five or six or seven bulleted words that you can't use, words that would make it too easy. For those of you who played, think about how hard it is, once you've seen those six words, not to think of one of those six words, because your focus has already become anchored. If you say one of those six taboo words, you immediately lose the point. Often what you shouldn't say frames and dominates thinking to make it hard to get beyond the taboo words to offer reasonable clues. Well, this is what focus does. We get what we focus on, so that's why a positive focus, looking at what we want, not the inverse of what we don't want, but what we do want in a positive way, is the best focus. People have more comfort and confidence to go further when they carry the best parts of the past forward. Something that we do in coaching, although we may or may not call it by this, appreciative inquiry looks at how a person or an organization can study and define the best that there is and then use the information to build on what's already working. There's a whole body of work founded by Dr. Diana Whitney, the founder of Appreciative Inquiry. She was a guest of mine on my mastermind group and has some terrific work that I think is really useful. I want to just summarize here. She described systematic studies of appreciative inquiry that shows three major findings, three major aspects. Focusing on what works enhances what works. Ask about what you want more of rather than problems or barriers. Think about how many meetings you go into that are framed by, let's solve this problem. Secondly, focus becomes a reality. A focus on possibility elicits a positive mindset. Focus on problems elicits a problem mindset. There have been some corporate studies of this that I think have been monumental, and I'm only summarizing it here. So, third, appreciative inquiry awakens possibility, leads to an aha experience. Here's an example. Studies by Dr. David Copperwriter applying appreciative inquiry found that asking about problems creates a problem mindset in the recipient, while asking about success creates a success mindset. The question launches the story. A head athletic coach who attempted to lead his team to victory told them, "I know what it takes to win games. I know how to condition the players and to map game strategy. I lead the team by letting each player know what I expect of him and exactly what to do." You can see my challenge in working with him. Unfortunately, this had not worked for him. The result was that the team was not close to peak performance and to winning results. And the coach couldn't understand why his players, elite players, a very recognized program, were not taking his directives. The outstanding athletes did not feel valued, respected, but felt judged and criticized. So, let's apply this to mindfulness training and to peak practice. When Phil Jackson introduced mindfulness meditation after taking over as head coach of the Chicago Bulls, they won six NBA championships. Then as coach of the Los Angeles Lakers, he again introduced mindfulness meditation to his team. They won five NBA championships, far and away the most of any coach. In a study in the Journal of Cognitive Enhancement, researchers at the University of Miami found that expert athletes who practiced mindfulness for 12 to 15 minutes a day were more able to withstand emotional and mental demands of physical training, had greater resilience, and importantly had sustained performance focus. The essential simplicity of meditation is to focus on one thing, such as your breath, and give full attention to that focus. When your mind wanders, which it will, notice that it's wandered and simply move back to your point of focus on your breathing. Don't follow it. Don't start free associating to whatever you've begun to free associate to. When your mind wanders again, refocus again. This is what your mind does. This is the purpose of mindfulness, meditation, focus. Keep doing this, and your focus and attention will become easier. Being aware of this process is a way of being aware of awareness. The selective attention, especially when repeated with mindfulness daily, aligns the energy field of your brain. Let's do a brief mindfulness focus meditation exercise. I would suggest that you close your eyes, not read along in the outline, although it's there. Close your eyes and get in a very relaxed position. Be aware of how fully and comfortably your seat is holding you. Set in a comfortable, seated, upright position. Take a deep breath in to breathe in relaxation and breathe out any tension. Keep your eyes closed and focus only on your breathing, specifically the flow of air in and out of your nose. As you focus just on your breath in and out, relax your body. Attend only to your breathing, only following its movement in and out of your body. When your mind wanders, refocus on your breath. Feel your whole body move and relax with your breath. If you have a thought, watch it come and watch it go without engaging it. Continue breathing as your center of focus. Anchor this state with a cue of a simple gesture or word or phrase. Finally, release your focus on breathing and simply sit, being aware of your relaxed state, of your body, and the experience of unfocus. Pause for a moment to gradually re-enter usual awareness. And do that and open your eyes as you're ready. Consider ending this meditation with a specific gratitude, something you're grateful for in present time as you're aware of the relaxed state of your muscles and the steadiness of your heartbeat. In a number of studies, a focus on gratitude boosts energy levels, enhances resilience, and increases beneficial hormones in the body. The first thing I do when I lie down in bed each night is to reflect on what I am grateful for. Now, what we just did, this mindfulness training can be a specific, deliberate practice component for optimum performance. Psychological changes in the brain with these practices have been shown to generate faster learning, decrease stress, and enhance performance. Now, consider this. I want to talk with you about the neural tools, the brain tools for deliberate practice. Consider these questions and answer immediately and honestly. Are you getting better at the things you most care about? Or are you not improving much at things that matter to you despite spending a lot of time working hard at them? The prevailing theory for decades held that experience was the key to expertise. The more somebody practiced, the more expert they became. 10,000 hours to develop significant expertise. Yet, compelling research shows that we don't gain experience from experience alone. Dr. Anders Ericsson has spent his professional lifetime studying the elements of experts as they become experts. He studied the art and science of how someone practices to become expert and what they do to then perform exceptionally. Deliberate practice. Here's the zinger. Research reveals that after the initial couple of years in a profession, performance can plateau. This is usually a result of movement away from time in the learning zone to focus time on performing. An example, older and more experienced physicians paradoxically can perform worse than younger, less experienced colleagues. The reason for this documented finding is initially not obvious. While the younger physicians have received more current knowledge and training in school, continuing education of experienced physicians should bridge that gap, and the gap should be further widened by years of experience in the trenches. But this is usually not the case. What's missing, we know now, is deliberate practice. A conclusion reached by Ericsson and colleagues is that with few exceptions, people don't gain experience from experience alone. Experience doesn't make an expert. How someone practices informs how someone performs. And the vast majority of learning and growing occurs during practice, not during performance. Intense focus on crafting a specific goal with openness for input from a mentor proves significantly more effective than massive repetition or regular practice. With artists, intellectuals, athletes, consistent findings by Ericsson's team was that neither experience nor practice was the crucial variable. Deliberate practice was. Expertise is not about the total number of hours of practice, as in the 10,000-hour rule, but the type of practice that fills those hours makes the crucial difference. For example, Dr. Ericsson and his team found that the number of years of practice had no correlation with how successful a clinical psychologist was with his or her patients. He found that in a number of instances, significant expertise, such as in physics professors and practicing physicians, did not do as well as newcomers in their respective areas. Repetition of the same experience is very different from deliberate practice focused on improving. In fact, practice itself can make you worse. Every shot that misses its mark is making your aim worse. This is the neuroscience of deliberate practice. The creation of muscle memory is a process of myelination, of rewiring your brain. Repetition of specific intended motor skills rewires so that each time, over and over, it becomes faster, easier, and smoother. The drawback is that a skill performed in the wrong way can also become hardwired. So the solution is not to try harder, but to try differently. For example, to approach a barrier from a different direction, such as to work with a teacher or a coach, someone who's familiar with the obstacles and can suggest ways to overcome them, like a dedicated mentor. Here are four simple steps to change a behavior. Identify the goals. Determine the mindset and behaviors to achieve them. Develop an action plan. And program new identity to incorporate the changes. Now, here are the two biggest challenges in changing any behavior. the mind's inclination to create certainty by repetition of the known outcome. This is a bias to want immediate closure and predictability, even if it's not the result you want. You can take off and go to the mall after you bring closure, even though it's not the right cause and effect or not the best closure. Secondly, the brain has rewired repeated behavior and has an error detection mechanism that alerts to anything other than repetition of the familiar. Any change, even good, cues this isn't right, this isn't what I expect. So let's look at two things that are both very, very important and informative about developing deliberate practice. And I'm going to conclude this portion with the steps of deliberate practice. First, let's look at the learning zone and the performance zone. These are actually two different states of mind, two different mindsets. The characteristics of elite performers in business, sports, various endeavors are all similar because they all start with mindset. We have two distinct mindsets, performance-related mindsets, a learning zone and a performance zone. In a learning zone, the goal is to improve, to concentrate on what you want to master. We expect to make mistakes and learn from them. Deliberate practice occurs in the learning zone, not the performance zone. In a performance zone, the goal is to do something as best as possible, to execute what has already been practiced. Yogi Berra said, you can't think and hit at the same time. These are two different zones, two different mindsets. The learning zone maximizes growth and future performance. The performance zone maximizes immediate performance. Research on the deliberate practice mindset shows that anyone can improve with the right approach. If you're not improving, it does not mean that you lack basic talent, but it may be because you're not practicing in the best way. There are studies and even books, one called The Talent Code, that conclude that it's not about innate talent. It's about these factors that we're talking about right here. Deliberate practice involves these five specific activities in a learning zone. Focus on a specific skill to improve on. Specify a specific goal, not just getting better, but a specific goal for that segment of practice. Determine a challenge beyond your comfort zone. If we keep doing what's in our comfort zone, we won't get better. If our story works, there's no reason to change it. Use feedback with repetition and adjustments on execution. Engage the guidance of a skilled coach or mentor to correct mistakes and introduce new possibilities. Practice does not make perfect. Practice makes permanent, from a brain perspective. Practice of even a slightly incorrect skill sequence will result in permanent etching of that incorrect sequence. The right kind of practice carried out over a sufficient period of time leads to improvement. Deliberate practice is significantly more important in performance than predefined talent or ability. Only deliberate practice with expert information and mentoring will result in enhancing expertise and developing skill. Deliberate practice modifies the structure and function of the brain, increasing the ability to perform skillfully. And as I said, deliberate practice always pushes a comfort zone, employing a growth mindset of moving beyond what is known and comfortable and repeated. Improvement always resides just beyond a comfort zone. So here are the seven framework principles of developing significant skills with deliberate practice. Choose an activity you deeply want to improve. Establish a fixed time for each practice. Limit practice sessions to perhaps an hour at a time in order to maintain intense focus. That doesn't mean you can't stack your hours during the day. You just want to have a period of unfocus of a few minutes each hour. We'll come back to that. Establish concrete signs for improvement. Every day when I go to LA Fitness, always part of a repeated announcement is what gets measured gets improved. And no matter how annoying it is, that is absolutely right. Connect with like-minded people who believe in what you're doing. This is about connection, bonding, and establishing a milieu that is supportive and enhancing. Align what you do with your core ideals. Your core ideals that are attainable, that you live up to, that's where your sense of esteem, self-esteem comes from. If it came from any other place, it would have a different first name than self-esteem. And seven, establish SMART goals. And you guys know this from coaching. Specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, time-bound. New York Times multiple bestseller Jeanine Roth, who's a buddy of mine, whose work I admired, was an expert content contributor in one of my mastermind groups. In response to one of the questions about writing her books, Jeanine surprised me. She revealed that she never lets any writing be seen by anyone until she's done at least 30 edits. Each edit improves, refines, focuses. As part of this practice, she gets feedback from savvy readers. I've been one of those. I can't say how savvy, but this is part of the deliberate practice of being a bestseller writer. So let's look now at mental representations and deliberate practice. This is a huge component, I think. 100 CEOs were interviewed by Accenture to determine the skills needed for executive success. Of 14 abilities that were crystallized from these interviews, one particular ability summarized these characteristics. Number one of all of these, self-awareness. Self-awareness is the foundation of all deliberate practice. To know to ask is half the answer. To be able to reflect on oneself and performance requires this ability to be attuned to all levels of self and performance, to incorporate the flexibility of taking in new information in order to change. You know, I always think I'm doing terrific. This is the purpose of a mentor coach, to tell you, hey, let's look at this a little more carefully. Self-awareness is a particular system's understanding of the self to look both subjectively and objectively at patterns of emotion, behavior, and attachment to others, including communication. The ability to see oneself, to recognize patterns, to think systematically are important aspects to understand your own dynamics and the dynamics of others. Now, a component of deliberate practice is developing a corresponding mental representation of the specific process and structure of what outstanding performance is. Whatever that endeavor, physical, emotional, skill, art, science, whatever it is, mental representations allow you to see meaningful patterns and live into them. Deliberate practice develops mental representations that enhance and perfect performance and form the foundation of revising an internal model that incorporates the changes to make them permanent. So here are five questions to ask for each performance goal you set. Is your goal specific? Is it measurable? Is your goal positive? Is your goal inspiring to you? And is your goal displayed? Is it evident? Erickson summarizes that the central purpose of deliberate practice is to develop mental representations that organize the execution and the future execution of skills. Deliberate practice is designed to make these mental representations improve over time, and the body will follow. Now, do you remember a specific moment in a performance you did or an outstanding play you executed? Peak experiences are personal moments of a lasting positive effect, an exciting and fulfilling high point of an instance that's maybe unusually intense and meaningful. These flashbulb moments of personal high points of exciting and fulfilling experiences serve as an example, a moment, a positive representation, or a highlight of a whole set of experiences. These instances can serve as organizer and motivator for other performance-based activities. Peak experiences, like peak performances, are most likely to occur in a state of flow, a sustained state of mind that accesses and stays in the state to execute the skill developed in that state by deliberate practice. Flow, which is described as being in the zone, is an ideal mental state for executing an activity with full access to that developed skill, whether it's physical, whether it's writing, whether it's artistic, as well as the experience of its enjoyment. Flow, in and of itself, is rewarding, pleasurable, and internally motivated, and staying in flow is when you access and sustain access to all the skills of that deliberate practice. Now, implicit learning is unconscious. While the learning practice and acquisition component are focused and conscious, the memory patterns and execution are system one. They're unconscious. The right kind of conscious framework and focus, though, is required to execute, to access and execute this unconscious memory. So, elite performers are trained to be able to make the right decision at the right time without thinking about it. For example, a soccer goalie intercepts an incoming shot in a nanosecond of response. A race car driver accelerates precisely at the instant of a cornering turn. I've worked with two race car drivers who describe this experience, but understandably have difficulty in deconstructing the elements of exactly how they do it. The link between perception and action, the time between seeing and doing, is instantaneous and precisely formed. I've seen the fastest land animal, a cheetah in Africa, run at an amazing speed and be able to instantaneously shift course in order to avoid an obstacle or to pursue a prey. The unconscious pattern development is not overridden by logic, conscious intellect. It's installed by deliberate practice and becomes automatic, becomes part of flow. So here's one aspect I'll call the last shot. When I began playing basketball with my son and daughter in the driveway, we would never end on a miss. They had to make, because I said, they had to make the last basket they shot before we stopped. Later, when I coached their basketball team, same reason, each player had to make the last basket he or she shot before we ended practice. I had no basis for this. There was no scientific. It just seemed to kind of make sense. Somehow, I knew intuitively that endings make a difference. Even brief, seemingly meaningless endings of our driveway basketball or our Tuesday night team practices before the big game on Saturday at age 8 and 9 and 10. Later, I would learn of Dr. Daniel Kahneman's research on peak experience, that the two times of the most impactful experience and subsequent memory are one at the moment of greatest emotional impact and two, the ending. My son, 2 years older than my daughter, taught me about the importance of a performance state of mind. with his being the first team I ever coached at his age 8. We would together as a group in our home gym the day of the game, shoot briefly, and go over the rudimentary plays that we had. The team would then all pile into my car, remember this was the era before mandatory seatbelts, and drive to the gym where we would play. And at their suggestion, we would listen at high volume all the way to Eye of the Tiger, a raucous repetition of the song in which they all sing along at high volume, got everybody into the spirit of the game. Then, 2 years later, when I began coaching my daughter's all-girl basketball team, when she reached age 8, we began each practice in the same way, with a little inspirational talk, teamwork, moving directly into basics, then scrimmage. It didn't work. They were all distracted and didn't seem to respond, as if they were there for something besides basketball. I was baffled. As I listened to them, though, and observed more closely, I began to sense maybe what I'd missed. Basketball, to me, was the purpose, the content of the practice, but their state of mind focused on the process of being together, of playing together. While I was urging them to concentrate on being competitive, they just wanted to enjoy themselves and each other. Soon enough, we began practice by warming up of sitting in a circle and just talking. That was the warm-up, and it worked. They played way better as a team. Same thing for pre-game warm-up. We all piled into my car and gossiped on the way to the game. How strange yet wonderful I thought it must be to be a girl. To win by not focusing on winning and to apologize when you foul an opponent was never a consideration for me. My daughter still contributes to my continuing education by giving me 4 granddaughters. End of footnote here. Oh, so let's talk about unlearning. Some of you have heard me mention this study before, but I want to reiterate it here to make a point about unlearning, which is a major component to learning. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Every day, the subjects picked a different option from poles of contrasting behaviors, lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive, talk about sports, talk about business. They would pick one of those and all day behave according to this assignment. So an introverted person, for example, would act as an extrovert for the entire day. Additionally, twice weekly, they had to stretch to behave in a way outside their usual pattern. They would eat something twice a week they had never eaten before, and they would read something at least twice a week they had never read before. After 4 months, the remarkable finding, remarkable to me, was the subjects lost an average of 11 pounds. And 6 months later, almost all had kept the weight off and some continued to lose weight. Now, this baffled the researchers. The weight loss impact of a non-diet was confusing to them. This was a study focusing on change and its impact. But the rationale they discovered, requiring people to change routine behavior makes them actually think about decisions rather than habitually choosing a default mode without consideration. This is story busting in an indirect way to create awareness of each person's choice architecture. In having to process decisions actively, they exercise their choice and decision-making abilities, extending to other choices such as what they eat and what not to eat. Once you become aware you're actively making choices, you can decide what's in your interest, what furthers your story, and what doesn't. Many came, for example, to ask with each bite, is this in my best interest? Every bite became an awareness of the choice architecture of their developing story. Think about how this is exactly what we do in mentor coaching. We help someone become more aware of their story to look at what components they want to enhance, what they want to change, and what they want to just delete. The brain changes when we learn something new. Each step of learning must involve at the same time an unlearning. why is it a lot easier for a child to learn a foreign language? Well, part of the answer, the beginner's mind is the essence of this process because the child doesn't have to forget or unlearn something and replace it with a newly acquired, but simply to learn something new, a beginner's mind. Inevitably, however, each must be, let me say it a different way, much must be unlearned in order to replace it with a new behavior, like a new habit, when one already exists. Learning is not the simple acquisition of information, but of a practice behavior that's introduced with much already existing behavior in place in the brain as an anatomical reality. And some may be specifically in contrast to that new learning. Doing a slightly different forehand, a slightly different stance in tennis, is not as easy as seeing an instructor and adopting the move. The old ways of doing things, an ingrained behavior pattern played out, has to be unlearned. An ingrained attachment pattern played out in a business relationship, already there in the brain. A habit simply means that you have, by repetition, rewired your brain to make a particular behavior or thought pattern or attachment pattern automatic with specific cues. Once a habit's in place, it's an anatomical reality in your brain with corresponding neuronal pathways and networks that execute that habit. So, simply presenting an alternate or a better pattern doesn't just overwrite the program already in your brain. Change can occur, but it's a process of doing a new behavior and undoing or not engaging the one that it replaces. These are the neural substrates of learning of skills, whether it's physical or cognitive. A habit engages software that was created for a past experience. It's useful, and it can tremendously expedite the default and effortless execution, but it's no longer useful and outdated, then a new behavior pattern needs to be created. A simple strategy then becomes to not fight old habits because that engages them, but simply to start new ones. That's why we look at possibilities in mentor coaching, because that activates new aspects of the brain rather than examining problems, which goes back into old, already established circuitry. Our habits have become invisible to us, so we have to become mindful of our choices and of the active process of choice in everything we do, every bite we take. We have to keep unlearning just as we keep learning to convert the mindlessness of automaticity into the mindfulness of change. Now, the ability to unlearn includes strategically not engaging a default neural connection, or if it automatically recurs, to quickly disengage and refocus on the new behavior that needs to be there side by side with the unlearning to gradually phase out the old behavior and neural wiring simply by not engaging. Being aware is always the first step to recognize authorship and own the story created. So this is self-directed neuroplasticity involving these three steps, or mentor-coach-directed neuroplasticity. Relabel the automatic old content or practice as an error message from the brain. Reframe the false brain message as not a directive for action, and specifically, as quickly as possible, refocus on the desired or productive activity or process. When we unlearn connections and associations, we weaken the chemical connections between neurons, which is also neuroplasticity, just in the opposite direction. Unlearning is neuroplasticity. This unlearning is necessary because our neuronal networks need to have new room created for new connections. The combination of strengthening some connections, learning, while weakening others, unlearning, keeps our neural networks from overload. So one final thing I want to mention, I took a little bit long in elaborating some things. I want to mention this and open it for questions. To put things in an output channel is part of deliberate practice, part of learning. So here's the answer you already have. So here's the question. If you were to take a test on a paper 8 pages in length, which of these methods would result in the greatest success? Reading those 8 pages 4 times in a row, trying to memorize them, or reading those 8 pages once, putting down the paper, and writing a 1-page summary? Research shows that the second strategy of putting knowledge into action results in 50% greater success. When an output channel is mobilized in the brain, it creates new neuronal networks and pathways to begin rewiring with the new information to complete the brain cycle. The most immediate result becomes a higher memory retrieval. Repeated findings by various investigators show that this type of targeted effort involving active reconstruction of what's learned can increase learning on average tenfold. Here's a study to incorporate in your thinking about your practice. In one study, when physician's assistants requested that the patient write the date and time of the appointment rather than doing it themselves, it lessened the no-show rate by 18%. Routine practice includes mental rehearsal. Performers like Michael Phelps and American aerialist Emily Cook write scripts of how a perfect performance looks and feels. Cook told the New York Times how she wrote entire scripts of what a perfect jump would look and feel like, and how she would replay the script in a recorder, then play the recorder with her eyes closed. These levels of deliberate practice include mental and physical combinations of execution. All performance expertise involves deliberate practice consistently developed through the output channel. There are no purely motor skills. There are no purely cognitive skills. It's an intricate synthesis of learning and expression and unlearning. Only in very recent time have neuroscientists been able to see the mechanism of the actual structure building of the cells that wrap more myelin around the fibers that fire. The more the nerve fiber fires, the more myelin wraps around it, so the faster and more effectively the signals travel. This process builds skill-specific broadband capacity in the central nervous system. Organization of this process involves feedback loop to monitor, compare, assist, and even revise responses. Cognitive skills like reading and vocabulary, as well as other mental and skill development, stimulates myelin growth. Myelin growth occurs when you actually practice to stimulate that nerve growth. Practice, rather than making perfect, makes myelin. And when practice is deliberate, specific skills develop and become hardwired. Every skill becomes a form of memory, and every form of memory is enhanced by focused, systematic practice. One more example. Canadian researchers at the University of Waterloo have shown that people learn better by expressing what they're learning. Speaking, singing, or dancing out loud improves long-term memory. Reading and vocalization combine two parts of the brain and strengthen memory by expression through an output channel. There's up to a 40% improvement in learning by reading a passage out loud rather than silently. It was shown in 2 controlled studies. So, to conclude, no matter how much we acquire information, study, and learn, it's by putting it into action in the output channel that we enhance effectiveness and create a performance memory. Putting something in an output channel brings together both sides of the brain, emotional and cognitive, that allows greater synthesis and connectedness with expression. This process facilitates both attention and retention. It makes it your story. I realize we're out of our hour, but I want to hang on if there are questions. I didn't intend for this to take nearly as long or quite as long. Questions or thoughts or clarifications about anything I've said, your impressions of it. Is this making sense to you?
Good night, Dave.
Oh, hey.
Hi, this is Lilita.
Welcome. Hey, any questions or any reflections?
I would like you to tell me, what would deliberate practice for a bank officer, for example, look like, or a CEO?
Deliberate practice for a what did you say?
A bank officer or a CEO of a company look like?
Okay, it would look review two things that I've said. The two aspects that you want to focus on to change your behavior. This includes developing executive expertise and leadership possibilities. Identifying the goals, determine the mindset and behaviors to achieve them, develop an action plan, and program new identity. Then look at how to convey this, but do it from the context of your own deliberate practice. And then once you, in those seven steps, and look at that, because that also contains the secrets of passing it on to a team, to a group, and creating a culture that is informed by the conversational and emotional and social intelligence that you've developed internally with yourself applied now to a team. So review the outline specifically with that question in mind, and I think you'll see applications in a different way than the focus that I did on individual development. Same principles in an expanded way to develop a culture, an organization, to apply in leadership, especially looking at appreciative inquiry. All those studies were done in an organization. David Copperwriter's research, all in an organizational setting. Conversational intelligence, Judith Glaser's work, a number of aspects of social and emotional intelligence, Daniel Goleman's work, all are synthesized to develop outstanding leadership because the focus is on the team.
Yes. Okay. Good.
So
thank you.
After you review that, reflect with us next time, if you would, what you've learned about that, or if you have or see any application. Would you give us a brief one paragraph summary next time of how you've reflected on this and how you'd apply it, and what if some questions you still have remaining?
I will. I certainly will.
That's a deal. All right. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Tell me your name again.
This is Lilita.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Super. Thank you.
Yes,
for that.
Good.
Any other comments? I know we're over, and I apologize for that, but any other comments or questions? That was an excellent one, and I look forward to thinking more about that with you. Other thoughts,
Dave,
questions, or reflections? Yes.
Dave, real quick, it's Mike Gennarino. I just,
hey.
I don't want to be long. How are you tonight?
Great.
What you went over tonight really sounds like a critical, important, great topic for leaders, executives, leaders, people responsible for teams, because it's kind of touching on is almost like this Pygmalion effect where the beliefs that our leaders, our mentors, our coaches, our teachers, our rabbis, if you will, have on the outcome, and that those leaders are the ones that really can instill a sense of belief in us, so to speak, as the performers. And they can either make or break the person doing the performing. And it's just really a very intriguing kind of a topic that would be, I think, extremely beneficial for leaders.
Absolutely, and it was not lost on you that I emphasized mentor coaching throughout as different examples. I just didn't give examples except in a couple of instances of sports application, but absolutely it has to do with leadership. One place you might want to look if you're interested in developing something like this, just for some of the language that you may need to create a bridge for developing programs or applications. There is a program that I've developed for creating an internal mentoring program for organizations, and you can see a description of it. And I think the table of contents of the curriculum that I have for that, or the resource guide, rather, is mentorpath.com/core mastery, CoreMastery. It's just one example of some applications there, and you'll see in the resource guide that it contains components of conversational and emotional and social intelligence. All are applications of some of the things that we talked about a bit more in the neuroscience of peak performance seminar. So thanks.
Great, thanks. I'll have a look.
Anything else, just very quickly, before we have to stop? And thank you for holding on a bit longer. Well, thank you for your attention and energy and your feedback and any things that you think of before we meet next time. Fire them off to me in an email, and I'll incorporate them at the beginning of our next seminar in a discussion. So thanks very, very much. Look forward to picking up with you right here next time. Have a great rest of the week. See you guys.
Thank you. Do the same. Night, all.